Today, the final program in this series. We conclude with Shakespeare's final years and a brief appreciation of his work.
When the London theaters reopened in 1660 after having been shuttered by the Puritans for 18 years, the Restoration decided that Shakespeare needed rewriting. Taking its cue from Ben Jonson, Shakespeare wanted art. The Restoration and the Age of Reason argued that the bard was a barbaric child of nature whose warbled wood notes, wild, violated the Aristotelian unities of time, place, and action. His plots were a confusing mishmash of the tragic and comic. He was vulgar. Samuel Pepys confided to his diary that Hamlet disgusts this refined age. Dryden called him divine Shakespeare, but added smugly, "I have refined his language, which before was obsolete." Voltaire may have summed up his era's widespread judgment on the bard, "a few pearls on a dunghill." For a century and a half, Shakespeare was vivisected and prettified. The biting vigor of the language was made toothless. In the original, a half-demented Macbeth rounds on a servant with,
"Devil damn thee black, thou cream-faced loon! Where got'st thou that goose look?"
Rewriter Sir William Davenant, Shakespeare's godson, refined this into, "Now, friend, what means thy change of countenance?" Romeo and Juliet stayed alive. False Cressid remained true to Troilus. And in the most bizarre happy ending of the lot, King Lear's daughter Cordelia married Edgar, and Lear was offered back his kingdom. Adapter Nahum Tate, who also edited out Lear's Fool, this cut lasted for 157 years, solemnly declared that his only purpose was making the tale conclude in a success for the innocent, distressed persons. "Declamation roared while passion slept," said Dr. Johnson of the ranting style of early 18th century acting. Then David Garrick, who had an indifferent voice and a remarkably expressive face, a deaf-mute, was one of his most ardent fans, pioneered a conversational, non-declamatory style. Although he restored some of the verse and affected to play as written by Shakespeare, Garrick did his own tampering with the text. The gravediggers were missing in his Hamlet, as was Ophelia's funeral, and Laertes had no pact with a king to kill Hamlet. As far as the public was concerned, it was the case of mime over matter, audiences thrilled to volcanic Edmund Kean playing Tate's sugar-coated Lear, and demanded that mesmeric Sarah Siddons ring down Macbeth on the sleepwalking scene in her farewell appearance. Victorian prudery nice nellified 19th century Shakespeare. In 1818, Thomas Bowdler, a retired physician, blue-penciled what he regarded as the bard's blue lines and produced a Shakespeare without blushes for the family reading hour. Doubtless pleasing that Victorian matron who emerged from a performance of Antony and Cleopatra, saying, "How strangely different from the home life of our dear queen." In the U.S., Shakespeare was so passionately popular that a dispute between the fans of rival actors, William Charles Macready and Edwin Forrest, led to New York City's famed Astor Palace riot, in which 22 people were killed. But in the U.S., too, touring companies were beset by moralizers, and as they played the bard in gold rush camps and over billiard rooms, the actors placated indignant religious sectarians by billing Othello as a moral dialogue depicting the evil effects of jealousy. Except for the lambently poignant Ellen Terry, England suffered an early 20th century eclipse of great Shakespearean acting. Performers had their minds on the theater of social significance and considered Shakespeare the kiss of death. The turning point came with the emergence of the contrasting twin giants John Gielgud, whose melodious, grief-numbed Hamlet was this generation's finest, and Laurence Olivier, whose body English makes him Shakespeare's angry young man, forever Hotspur, whether he is a sinuously satanic Richard III, a black-as-thunder Macbeth, or a plangent patriot King Henry V. Not far behind these triumphs are Maurice Evans' sterling silver-tongued Richard II, Ralph Richardson's roguishly intelligent Falstaff, and Michael Redgrave's mettlesome, love-ravished Antony. They are the leaders of today's functional Shakespeare, in which action flows naturally along the firm riverbed of the verse, making clearer than ever that while the play's the thing, to prove it, the player must be the real thing. Some of the gimmick productions are offensive, but they do not necessarily violate the author's spirit. They are possible only because Shakespeare is timeless. He says everything. Protestants, Catholics, and agnostics claim him. So do aristocrats and egalitarians, optimists and pessimists. He is loved by the pure in heart and delights those who feel that a dirty mind is a continual feast. The modern critics of Shakespeare argue that he lacks a point of view. T.S. Eliot charges that his philosophy was inferior to Dante's. G.B. Shaw finds that he offers no message of social uplift and ranks him below G.B. Shaw. No one has been more explosively anti-bard than Shaw.
What a crew they are, these Saturday to Monday athlete stockbroker Orlandos. These villains, fools, clowns, drunkards, cowards, intriguers, fighters, lovers, patriots, hypochondriacs who mistake themselves and are mistaken by the author for philosophers and princes.
And yet, like most other critics, Shaw had to concede.
I am bound to add that I pity the man who cannot enjoy Shakespeare. The imagery, scenes, and people he has created become more real for us than our actual life.
No single philosophy dominates the plays. The closest thing to it may be Shakespeare's conviction that the social order must be restored, a kind of Fortinbras complex. The election lights on Fortinbras, in which the corpse-encumbered stage is tidied up in Act 5, Scene 5. In terms of the intriguing concept developed in Sir Isaiah Berlin's The Hedgehog and the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing, William Shakespeare is the prince of foxes. The hedgehogs are the great systematic thinkers, and since life is not systematic, they are also the great excluders. The great men of feeling, of whom Shakespeare was the greatest, are the great includers. That may be why men turn to Shakespeare, as they seem to, in especially troubled times. There is a rough parallel between Shakespeare's day and the present. The Elizabethan view of man was being threatened by a triple revolution. Copernicus had challenged the Earth-centered universe, Montaigne had skeptically consigned man to the lowest rung of the animal kingdom, and Machiavelli had argued that statecraft was a matter of the basest self-interest, devoid of moral principle. Modern man has seen Einstein throw a curve into the cosmos, Freud lift the lid on the cauldron of the unconscious, and Marx upturned continents with the doctrine of dialectical materialism, in which the end justifies the means. What does Shakespeare say to an era that feels that the times are out of joint? He does not renounce the world or wallow in self-pity. He is the poet of this worldliness. He celebrates love, food, drink, music, friendship, conversation, and the changing, changeless beauties of nature. Though life is time's fool, Shakespeare posits the ideal of the mature man, ripeness is all, who distills his experiences into common sense and uncommon wisdom. Yet man is also a quintessence of dust, and men must endure their going forth even as their coming hither. Shakespeare's tragic hero is called upon to face the unfaceable. Critic Walter Kaufmann has noted that the tragic hero, as Shakespeare conceived him, fits Aristotle's description of the great-souled man. He claims much and deserves much. One reason why the Willie Lomans, the Blanche Duboises, and the poor, driven people of O'Neill are pseudo-tragic and fail to exalt an audience is because they are small-souled. They claim little and deserve little. They cannot fall because they are already down. Shakespeare's tragic hero dies with no hope of reward. As he meets his fate, the audience feels, there but for the grace of God goes a better man than I. What links the audience movingly with the tragic hero is the quality that essentially separates them, nobility. That nobility often rests on the splendor of the language, but beautiful lines alone may reach no farther than the ear. Shakespeare speaks to the soul. He speaks in metaphor, which relates world to self, thing to thing, in the endless chain of being. Shakespeare could do anything he wanted with language. The way he talks of a thing conjures up the thing itself. The lines, not poppy, nor mandragora, nor all the drowsy syrups of the world, shall ever medicine thee to that sweet sleep which thou owedst yesterday. hypnotized with their own heavy-lidded evocation of sleep. He packed worlds into monosyllables. To be or not to be is man's largest question put in man's smallest and simplest words. Once uttered, they expand to fill all the space in the human mind. Shakespeare's breathtaking change of pace carries a man to the brink of eternity and then restores him to common humanity. On seeing Cordelia's body, the grief-stricken Lear cries,
"Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life? And thou, no breath at all."
In the extremity of human despair,
"Thou come no more."
He utters his towering fivefold,
"Never, never, 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 never."
Then the dam of his unbearable anguish breaks with a homely request,
"Pray you undo this button."
No one but Shakespeare would have dared to put those two lines together. No one but Shakespeare could.
William Shakespeare died on April 23rd, 1616, and was buried on April 25th. John Ward's diary for 1661 to 1663 attributes the death to a fever contracted during a drinking bout with Drayton and Johnson. But the fact that the will was made so shortly before and the fact of the trembling signatures upon the will suggest a prolonged final illness. The grave is under the chancel of Stratford Church. There is a doggerel curse on the gravestone.
"Good friend, for Jesus' sake forbear to dig the dust and close it here. Blessed be the man that spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones."
A letter from William Hall, rector of Acton, Middlesex, to Edward Thwaites in 1694 discusses the epitaph and seeks to explain the lameness of the lines.
"The little learning these verses contain would be very strong argument of the want of it in the author. Did not they carry something in them which stands in need of a comment? There is in this church a place which they call the Bone House, a repository for all the bones they dig up, which are so many that they would load a great number of wagons. The poet, being willing to preserve his bones unmoved, lays a curse upon him that moves them, and having to do with clerks and sextons, for the most part a very ignorant sort of people, he descends to the meanest of their capacities, and disrobes himself of that art, which none of his contemporaries wore in greater perfection."
Comments by Shakespeare's contemporaries concerning the personality and character of the poet-dramatist are generally favorable. Ben Jonson's comment in Timber or Discoveries has often been cited.
"For I love the man, and do honor his memory. On this side, idolatry, as much as any. He was indeed honest, and of an open and free nature."
When the early biographers of Shakespeare began to assemble their material late in the 17th century, they drew upon the traditions that had been established concerning Shakespeare the man. John Aubrey in 1681 reported that Shakespeare,
"He was a handsome, well-shaped man, very good company, and a very ready and pleasant smooth wit, a most prodigious wit."
Nicholas Rowe incorporated a good deal about Shakespeare the man into his biography of 1709.
"Besides the advantages of his wit, he was in himself a good-natured man of great sweetness in his manners, and a most agreeable companion, so that it is no wonder if with so many good qualities he made himself acquainted with the best conversations of those times. What particular habitude or friendships he contracted with private men I have not been able to learn, more than that everyone who had a true taste of merit and could distinguish men had generally a just value and esteem for him. His exceeding candour and good nature must certainly have inclined all the gentler part of the world to love him, as the power of his wit obliged the men of the most delicate knowledge and polite learning to admire him.
When Shakespeare finally retired to Stratford, Rowe tells us,
"His pleasurable wit and good nature engaged him in the acquaintance and entitled him to the friendship of the gentlemen of the neighborhood."
The 20th century man, still floundering in the backwash of Romanticism, insists upon the importance of the individual personality. It is difficult for men today to believe that the man is nothing and that the work is everything. Ever since the beginning of the Romantic movement, readers of Shakespeare have been dismayed by the paucity of material available concerning the personality of William Shakespeare. They have fervently desired personal details, personal letters, accounts of idiosyncrasies. One inevitable result of such fond desire has been a series of attempts at fraud.
One fantastic attempt at fraud can be traced to the year 1793, when Samuel Ireland and his 17-year-old son, William Henry, arrived in Stratford. Samuel was a kindly, absurd, ingenuous man, utterly devoted to the glory of Shakespeare. He came to Stratford to draw, in his incompetent way, some picturesque views on the Warwickshire Avon. His son, William Henry, had grown up hearing little but Shakespeare, and had often heard his father moan aloud about the dearth of information available concerning Shakespeare the man. The dearest hope of Samuel Ireland was that he would discover someday an original Shakespearean manuscript. Perhaps, he endlessly mused, in some remote corner of an obscure dwelling in Stratford, there were letters written by Shakespeare, or notes written by Shakespeare, or even hitherto unknown poems and plays. Unfortunately, the visit of 1793 resulted in no such discovery, but it did have the effect of intensifying Samuel's worship of Shakespeare. In December of 1794, young William Henry came to his father with an astonishing bit of news. He said that he had met a wealthy young gentleman who had invited him to inspect some ancient documents in a chest of family papers. There he had found a mortgage dated 1610. He dramatically presented the deed to his father, and Samuel Ireland began to read. The mortgage was between
William Shakespeare of Stratford-on-Avon, gent of the one party, and Michael Fraser, and Elizabeth, his wife, of the other party.
The document bore the signature of William Shakespeare. Samuel Ireland immediately soared into uncontrollable ecstasy, and William Henry returned to his homemade brown ink, his old parchment, and his study of Shakespeare's handwriting. Shortly afterward, William Henry appeared with a note from Shakespeare to his colleague John Heming, promising to pay Heming 5 shillings in return for
his great trouble in settling and doing much for me at the Globe Theatre, as also for his trouble in going down for me to Stratford.
Then followed letters from Shakespeare to the Earl of Southampton, and from the Earl to Shakespeare. These letters concerned the £1,000 that Southampton had given to Shakespeare. Samuel broke the news to the world. The Ireland home became the focus of confused excitement, and young William Henry speeded up his tempo. Soon there was a letter to Shakespeare from Queen Elizabeth herself, and a letter from Shakespeare to Anne Hathaway.
Dearest Anna, as thou hast always found me to my word most true, so thou shalt see I have strictly kept my promise. I pray you, perfume this my poor lock with thy balmy kisses, for then indeed shall kings themselves bow and pay homage to it, I do assure thee. No rude hand hath knotted it. Thy Willis alone hath done the work.
William Henry subsequently produced a copy of King Lear, which differed materially from any other extant edition. A hitherto unknown play called Vortigern and Rowena, and a hitherto unknown play called Henry II. The Miscellaneous Papers of Shakespeare, a collection of William Henry's discoveries, was published, and the play Vortigern was actually performed at the Drury Lane Theatre in London. By the time Vortigern was performed, the few Shakespearean scholars of the day who kept their heads were certain of the fraud. Edmund Malone published an inquiry into the authenticity of certain miscellaneous papers which demolished William Henry's puerile efforts. Vortigern was laughed off the stage, and William Henry had to settle for the publication of his confession, an authentic account of the Shakespearean manuscripts. Samuel Ireland clung pathetically to his belief in the great discoveries. He wouldn't listen to his son's confession and attacked Malone in an investigation into Mr. Malone's claim to the character of a scholar.
During Shakespeare's lifetime and for nearly 200 years after his death, no one doubted that the author of the works of Shakespeare was William Shakespeare. Doubt began with the advent of Romanticism. The Romantic reader must find the author clearly in his works. Beginning about the end of the 18th century, an increasing number of people became seriously disturbed at what they felt was a lack of correspondence between the works of Shakespeare and what was known of the life of William Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon. These people brooded over Shakespeare's inadequate education at the Stratford Grammar School, the probable illiteracy of his parents, the labored handwriting of Shakespeare's signatures, Shakespeare's preoccupation with money and property, the fact that no books were mentioned in his will, and the doggerel of his epitaph.
Broodings and observations began to form a theory. The supposed authorship of the plays by William Shakespeare was a grand deception. Early in the 19th century, there were tentative expressions of this theory. Next came tentative assertions that the author of the plays was, in fact, Francis Bacon.
Once the name of Bacon was proposed, theorists supporting other candidates began to sprout in every corner. In quick succession came the claims for William Stanley, the 6th Earl of Derby, Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, Sir Edward Dyer, Sir Walter Raleigh, at least 100 others, and finally Christopher Marlowe, who died in 1593.
It is perhaps instructive to follow some of the reasoning offered by those who would reveal the true author of the plays. The Honorable Ignatius Donnelly of Hastings, Minnesota, author of the great cryptogram, Francis Bacon's cipher in the so-called Shakespeare plays, presented this procedure.
I begin with the word volume in the first scene of Henry IV, Part 2 in the first folio. Note that it is the 208th word in the first column of page 75. Note that the number of words on page 74 is 532. Add 208 to 532 and obtain 740. Divide by the number of the page, 74, and obtain 10. Note that there are 10 words in brackets in the first column of page 74. Conclude that the bracketed words, the italicized words, and the hyphenated words form the hidden cryptogram.
Trace the cipher.
Dorothy and Charlton Ogburn, in their work, Shakespeare, the Real Man Behind the Name, published in 1962, plead the case for the Earl of Oxford. They pay particular attention to all characters in the plays whose names end in I-O or E-O.
Many of the characters whose names end in E-O may be identified as Oxford. Antonio, Romeo, Claudio. Malvolio, a recognizable caricature of Christopher Hatton, may be translated as Evil Willer to E.O. Benvolio as Goodwiller, etc. There is Juliet's readiness to tear the cave where Echo lives, with repetition of my Romeo's name. The echo of Romeo is Io, and the device is one Oxford used in the Anne Vavasor Echo poem. Again we have, here comes Romeo without his roe, like a dried herring. Without the roe, Mio is left. Me-o.
It is to be hoped that in this year of the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, all such madness will be at least temporarily forgotten. It is hoped that the semi-scholarly vandals who recently sought to open Shakespeare's grave will again be repulsed by the inscription on the stone. It is hoped that in 1964 there will be a cessation of efforts to explain genius or to explain it away.
Shakespeare survives because the next to the last word can be said about him, but not the last word. His creations are as opaque as life's. His characters remain inexhaustibly baffling. Next to Jesus, Napoleon, and Shakespeare himself, more may have been written about Hamlet than any other subject. The problem seems simple. Why does Hamlet take so long to kill the king? Goethe's answer was that Hamlet was an intellectual whose habit of thinking too precisely on the event sapped his will. Subsequently, psychoanalyst Ernest Jones fashioned a Hamlet with an Oedipus complex, whose dilemma was amusingly compounded because he somehow knew he had an Oedipus complex. Recently, Rebecca West produced the dissenting or beatnik Hamlet, who has the strength to kill the king but refuses to enter the corrupting cycles of social depravity and power politics. There has even been Olivier's so active, thought-free prince who proved to one critic's ironic satisfaction that Hamlet was too busy to kill the king. On grounds as relative as these, there has been and will be a spate of other Hamlets, for Hamlet and Shakespeare's other great characters are so rich in possible meanings because they are fashioned on the essentially human principle of both and rather than either or. Hamlet is more than the sum of his paradoxes. He is the paradox of man seen whole. All one knows for certain is that being Hamlet is Hamlet's tragedy, as being himself is every man's. Paraphrasing Keats, it might be said that Shakespeare's plays lead a life of allegory, and human existence is the commentary upon them. Every age and every man in his seven ages finds a reflection in Shakespeare's universal mirror. The passion and the poetry echo in the corridors of the mind, and truer than the infancy of truth, will go on echoing to the last of time.
You've been listening to This Was a Man. Today, the final program in a five-part documentary of William Shakespeare's life. The players were Joseph Burns as George Bernard Shaw and Ben Jonson, Bruce Timpson as William Hall, Richard Peel as Nicholas Rowe, Ben Wright as John Aubrey, William O'Connell as William Ireland, Donald Freed as Ignatius Donnelly, and Jean Burns as Dorothy Ogburn. This program series was based on a research text by John Monteverdi and the editorial from Time magazine of July 4, 1960, adapted for radio by Lee Whiting. This Was a Man was produced and directed by Ruth Hirschman and Lee Whiting, with technical assistance by Michael Dayton. The entire series was a production of the Drama and Literature Department of Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. Your announcer has been David Osmond.